We are the only minority group that you can join overnight.
From Overnight Productions.
In the twinkling of an eye, in fact.
Many doctors don't do a good job of dealing with trans patients, like my first endocrinologist, who thought that my trans identity was changeable.
WYBR Buffalo.
Is this Danger Dave?
Yeah.
You're such a faggot.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Cayman Islands court orders marriage equality, queer youth examine trans patient care, and David dances into danger on the radio. Those stories and more this week on the first show of the 31st year of This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 30th, 2019. Marriage equality has finally come to the Cayman Islands. Chief Justice Anthony Smella of the Grand Court issued his ruling on March 29th in a case brought by a lesbian couple declaring that the law defining marriage as exclusively heterosexual is unconstitutional and violates human rights. Chantelle Day and Vicky Bodden-Bush were turned away when they sought a marriage license in April 2018 and then filed a lawsuit. The Chief Justice wrote that the petitioners and their daughter are entitled to the indignities to which they have been subjected, being put to an immediate end by the court. This week's decision, said Day, shows that love wins. Attorney General Samuel Bulgin, however, told news reporters as he was leaving the courthouse that the government will have to take some time to consider it and think about how to move forward. The Cayman Islands is an autonomous British overseas territory in the Western Caribbean Sea. With about 60,000 inhabitants on its three islands, Grand Cayman, Cayman Brac, and Little Cayman, it's now the second most populated self-governing British overseas territory with marriage equality behind Bermuda, which opened civil marriage to same-gender couples last year. Northern Ireland, of course, remains the biggest part of the United Kingdom without marriage equality, thanks to a totally dysfunctional government and the British government's reluctance to intervene.
New laws taking effect this week in the East Asian nation of Brunei include punishing consensual adult same-gender sex with death by stoning. It would also punish Muslims convicted of adultery, sodomy, or rape with the same form of execution. Same-gender sex is already punishable in Brunei by up to 10 years in prison. The new statutes are part of a revised Islamic law-inspired penal code that drew international outrage when they were first announced in 2014. Brunei is ruled by its sultan, Hassanal Bolkiah, who approved the changes. The global outrage included boycotts of several high-end hotels he owns, including the Hotel Bel Air, the Beverly Hills Hotel, the Dorchester in London, and other properties in the UK, Paris, Rome, and Milan. That boycott faded in memory, even as the Sultan gradually enacted more parts of Brunei's full conversion to Islamic law, known as Sharia. But calls for a boycott were renewed this week with the announcement on the official website of Brunei's Attorney General that Sharia will come completely into force on April 3rd. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and several other global advocacy groups have condemned the harsh new laws in the strongest terms. The UK Foreign Office is warning queer British citizens about the potential danger of traveling to Brunei, while Australia has said it's probably okay as long as the LGBTQ person is not in-your-face out. Other governments are sure to weigh in the coming days. Filmmaker activist George Clooney is leading a number of well-known figures in calling for renewed action in response to the death by stoning threat LGBTQ people in Brunei will face under the new laws. As Clooney wrote in an open letter this week, "I've learned over years of dealing with murderous regimes that you can't shame them, but you can shame the banks, the financiers, and the institutions that do business with them and choose to look the other way." You can find a list of the Sultan's properties at thiswayout.org.
Police raided an LGBTQ community center in the northern Russian city of Arkhangelsk this week. They insisted on inspecting the group's headquarters in a nondescript office building while group lawyers, volunteers, and five visitors were prevented from leaving. While no one from the government has offered a comment so far, authorities probably acted under Russia's so-called no-promo-homo law that criminalizes the promotion of non-traditional sexual relations. Vladimir Putin signed the law against gay propaganda in 2013. There's been a steady rise in anti-queer violence ever since. The law has most often been used to deny requests for or to shut down LGBTQ pride marches. A spokesperson for the Arkhangelsk LGBTQ Center, known as RAKURS, said the police told them that their investigation this week was based on an unexplained complaint about the group. RAKURS was one of the LGBTQ groups on the Russian government's list of foreign agents in 2014 and was fined 300,000 rubles when the Putin administration decided that any group supporting human rights for LGBTQ people was clearly representing some sort of foreign ideology. But in response to this week's raid, the RAKURS spokesperson told the Barents Observer that lawyers for the group are ready to defend it, again, in court. It's been holding lectures, organizing seminars, and offering psychological and medical counseling for more than 10 years, and may be one of the oldest groups of its kind in Russia.
A U.S. appeals court this week lifted the final hurdle to the implementation of Donald Trump's ban on military service by qualified transgender people. While lawsuits challenging the policy are still making their way through lower courts, injunctions in four of them had prevented the Pentagon from moving forward on the policy. The Supreme Court struck down two of the injunctions, and a third district judge lifted his injunction based on the Supreme Court action. The D.C. District Court had maintained that its fourth injunction still stood because a final order of the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit on the case, which had struck it down in January, had not been issued. But a three-judge panel of the D.C. Appeals Court issued its final order this week. This means, barring a last-ditch final appeal to the full court, that an estimated 13,700 transgender service members out of a total of about 15,000 will be kicked out of the U.S. Armed Forces on April 12th, and other openly trans people will not be able to enlist. Defense Department officials insist that it's not a ban on transgender service members, but the new policy allows a trans person to serve only if they do so in their birth gender and vow not to transition while serving. Meanwhile, the Democratic-controlled U.S. House, led by Speaker Nancy Pelosi, approved a bipartisan resolution this week opposing the ban and the flawed scientific and medical claims upon which it is based. Five Republicans joined all the Democrats in a vote of 238 to 185.
In other news, global online giant Google has bowed to pressure from LGBTQ groups and other human rights groups and removed an app that purports to help people change their sexual orientation. The last straw for Google this week was apparently falling from the Human Rights Campaign's list of companies with a perfect corporate equality index score. Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon have already removed the Living Hope Ministries Gay Cure app for violating terms of service. It was still available to Android Google users until this week. The Texas-based Ministries claims that same-gender attraction is a sexual sin and calls it a sickness, an addiction, and a destructive lifestyle. Nearly every mainstream mental health organization, certainly in the Western world at least, rejects the claims of its proponents and considers so-called conversion therapy to be a danger to a patient's mental and physical health. The Trevor Project, a suicide prevention group serving LGBTQ youth, applauded the move in a statement that said, in part, that "We are glad Google has joined the rest of the technology sector in its rightful rejection of the dangerous and discredited practice which harms LGBTQ youth we serve each day." More than 140,000 people signed a Change.org petition calling on Google to pull the app from its Play Store. According to GayStar News, a separate petition calling on Apple to restore the app has, at last count, 47 signatures.
And finally, you might recognize Norwegian Airlines for its distinctive tail fins, which portray the likeness of different trailblazing historical figures who have pushed boundaries. Notables already featured include Roald Dahl, Henrik Ibsen, and Greta Garbo. The airline, which operates in all the Nordic countries, along with Spain, France, England, Ireland, Scotland, Argentina, and the U.S., announced the newest addition to its Tailfin Heroes fleet this week. He'll be smiling on the airline's newest Boeing 787-9 Dreamliner, which is based in London. But the service was set to launch on March 31st in San Francisco, the New York-born honoree's adopted home. The airline has already feted queer icons Freddie Mercury and Oscar Wilde. Have you figured out who the new Tailfin hero is? A Norwegian Airlines media statement said that Harvey Milk is being honored for bravery and courage that will span the globe for years to come, reinforcing our joint commitment to making the world a smaller, friendlier, and more inclusive place. Stuart Milk, Harvey's nephew and co-founder of the Harvey Milk Foundation, celebrated the news. "We look forward to seeing Harvey flying into airports across the globe," he said, "and continuing to spread his message of acceptance."
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending March 30th, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazor, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Hello, I'm Robbie Kaplan, the author of Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. And you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
Welcome to the wonderful world of being who you really are. It sucks. Big time.
David and his doppelganger discover how to not suck later in the program.
We go to the doctor. We go to the mountain. Yeah, we go to the Bible. We go through the workout. There's more than one answer to these questions pointing me in a crooked line. And the less I seek my source for some definitive, closer I am to find.
A doctor can be a formidable adversary, no matter how mature you think you are when you walk into the office. Many trans teens find themselves bringing an apple to a knife fight. We'll tell you about how some healthcare professionals are trying to address the issue, but first, one of Outcasting Overtime's queer youth commentators talks about the harm a bad doctor can do.
This is Outcasting Overtime, from Media for the Public Good, producer of Public Radio's LGBTQ youth programs. Hi, I'm Dhruv, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Andrew talks about a bad experience with a doctor.
When I was 15, I discovered that I had abnormally high testosterone levels for someone assigned female at birth. This happened after the blood supply to one of my ovaries was cut off, causing it to swell to about 8 inches long. When the ovary was removed, my testosterone levels went back down to what they were before, a medically normal level. But I'm a trans male, and I wasn't so happy about that. I wasn't out yet at the time, but I was fully aware by then that I was trans. My endocrinologist, whom I had started seeing just before my surgery, began to pick up on the fact that I was unhappy about my testosterone levels going back down and began to suspect that I was trans. Because I wasn't out to anyone, this was a very stressful and confusing situation for me. Rather than trying to have a straightforward conversation with me about my gender identity, the doctor dropped hints about it without ever addressing it directly, and spoke cryptically. She spoke to my mom a lot privately, with me in another room. Based on what my mom later told me, I suspect they were discussing my gender, but I was never sure exactly what was going on. Because I wasn't out, I was afraid to ask her directly about it, especially because I wasn't sure if she actually knew or if I was just being paranoid about being found out. This indirect discussion of my gender made it feel like a shameful taboo, something to be hidden. The doctor's lack of straightforwardness with me made me afraid of being straightforward with her. Then the situation got even worse. Scans showed that I was developing more ovarian cysts, and so the endocrinologist prescribed me with birth control containing estrogen. This is a common treatment for ovarian cysts, but not, as I would later discover, the only possible one. At my appointments, the endocrinologist discussed how the estrogen might supposedly treat or fix my gender identity. She repeated that she hoped the estrogen would resolve, as she put it, these feelings you're having, referring to my gender dysphoria. This made it clear that she didn't see my gender as legitimate, which made me feel rejected and dehumanized. And taking estrogen affected my body in ways that I did not want, making me feel like I was losing control. I already had gender dysphoria, which can make my relationship with my body very distressing and frustrating, and having to take female hormones made that so much worse. Back when the endocrinologist first prescribed me with birth control, I told my mom I didn't want to take it. Since the endocrinologist assured us that it was medically necessary, we came to a compromise. I would take the birth control but skip the monthly placebo that causes most people who take birth control to still have periods. The doctor didn't approve of this. Going forward, she began to insist that this decision was bad for my sense of gender because I wouldn't get used to being a girl without getting periods. She also insisted that it was bad for my physical health, but she was vague about why. As far as my mom and I could tell, this isn't true. Taking birth control continuously isn't uncommon, and no other doctor or source I've found says that it's unhealthy. Ultimately, I left this endocrinologist over this, in addition to a couple of other concerns that caused my mom to lose trust in her. I started seeing a new endocrinologist after this. By this point, I was out to a couple of people, so I told my new endocrinologist I was trans from the start. Unlike the other doctor, she had respectful, open discussions with me about my gender identity and my wants and needs for my body. Instead of birth control, she prescribed me Lupron, a drug that suppresses sex hormones. It works as a treatment for ovarian cysts by blocking sex hormones, and it's also commonly used as a puberty blocker for younger trans kids. And because it works to suppress estrogen, a sex hormone, it keeps me from getting periods or developing further feminine secondary sex characteristics as I wait to start testosterone. This was a great temporary solution for both my medical needs and my gender needs, and it came about because my doctor was willing to take my gender seriously and tailor my treatment to my situation. Seeing this new doctor gave my experience with my old doctor new perspective. The old doctor had told me that taking estrogen was medically necessary for me, so I had accepted that the damage it caused to my body was something I had to endure. Finding out that there were other solutions that didn't change my body in ways that I didn't want made it incredibly frustrating that I'd had to spend a year taking estrogen. My first doctor should have treated my gender identity as legitimate, like my second doctor did. She should have had an open discussion with me about what treatment options would have accommodated my needs and wants for my body. Instead, she took advantage of the fact that I wasn't yet ready to stand up for myself. Many trans people, especially those who medically transition or want to, end up interacting with the medical system a lot. Unfortunately, though, many doctors don't do a good job of dealing with trans patients, like my first endocrinologist, who thought that my trans identity was changeable. If doctors lack understanding of what it means or what it's like to be trans, they can end up mentally and physically damaging patients who need their help. I'll never get back that year of my life that I spent taking estrogen, and it's taken a lot of time for my self-esteem to recover from the way that doctor treated me when I was at my most vulnerable and insecure. If more doctors are better educated about trans people and our needs, more doctors can fulfill the purpose of their jobs, making people's health better, not worse.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization that produces public radio's LGBTQ youth programs. Our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
There are doctors who are looking for ways to improve their treatment of young transgender patients. A recent conference on the issues was co-hosted by two UK trans groups and the University of Bristol, Healthcare professionals from both sides of the pond clashed over questions about when and how to begin hormone therapy. UK physicians also noted the problem of the nearly 2-year waiting list for treatment through the National Health Service, a wait caused by the insufficient number of doctors with training in the field.
I'm Stephen Fry. The great Oscar Wilde once said, "The only sin is stupidity." That is why it is imperative that we stay as informed as possible. An excellent way to do this is to listen to This Way Out, the international radio program for all our sexually diverse communities.
Time for my personal favorite part of the show. We have some very special listeners out there who I think deserve a ring-a-ding-ding from Danger Dave. WYBR Buffalo.
Is this Danger Dave?
Yeah.
You're such a faggot.
Thanks for listening. I'll send an autograph.
A movie about queers on the radio? What could be closer to our hearts? Hopefully, entertainment correspondent John Dyer V and the rest of us at This Way Out are not quite as neurotic as the central character in The David Dance.
Welcome to the wonderful world of being who you really are. It sucks. Big time.
Pity poor Danger Dave Patrone. He seems to have a problem with expressing himself. That is, it's a problem when he isn't being Danger Dave, who really isn't actually dangerous at all. But he still has a problem. The David Dance, directed by April Winnie, does go back and forth in time. A bit confusing at first, but soon a kind of ping-pong rhythm emerges. Danger Dave is the host of a Buffalo, New York radio program, and you probably don't have to guess what the show is about.
Gay Talk. You're the guy from Gay Talk.
Donna, look who we have here. It's Danger Dave.
It does pretty well, despite Dave's not remembering who his show sponsor is, especially when he has to speak his mind on an issue. Then Dave's natural reticence, almost a pathological timidity, goes away, and we get to hear from an intelligent, thoughtful, and common-sense-spouting gay man. So dangerous. Dave relates, "When I'm alone in the studio, I feel safe. I can say what I want." The peril, at least the emotional peril, seems to encompass Dave more than anyone, as almost everyone else we meet in this story knows their own mind and has no trouble communicating. Did something happen to Dave? We see Dave's often outrageous older sister, Kate, who proclaims, "That's what sisters do. They gnaw on your brains." Which might be news to some of the other sisters out there. We learn that at 39, Kate has decided to adopt a Brazilian child named Margaret.
Can you help me?
What?
You know, if I need help raising him or her, whatever we decide.
Of course I will.
This, after a series of unhappy marriages, is something she feels adamantly sure of. It is certainly a long way from the time of her first wedding, where she was bulldozed into wearing a traditional wedding dress, despite her fervent avowals to shun a traditional ceremony. Will Kate successfully complete her adoption?
I'm Chris, your new technical assistant for the next few months.
The third character in this dramatic triangle is Chris, Dave's cute and amiable tech assistant on their show at WYBR. Chris professes to be a really big fan of Dave's, and he later exhibits the patience of Job when dealing with David's constant inability to decide, to speak, and to act. Their first kiss comes only 50 minutes into the story, and there were times I honestly wondered if our Dave was either clinically depressed or somewhat autistic. As he admits, it took me a long time to say the word gay. Suffice it to say that Dave would not have gotten very far in life were it not for Kate and Chris, who both exhibit depths of empathy and support that few others would muster. Apart from Kate and Chris, we get short glimpses of Dave and Kate's parents, who are apparently little to no help at all when it comes to being there for their children. Strangely, we never fully see the face of their father. His back is always turned, or else his face is partially obscured. This leaves a lot of room for speculation. Though he is pretty much his own worst enemy, a more obvious antagonist to Dave arrives in the form of ultra-Christian June Hanley, Gainesville, Florida's radio host of Inspire in the Evening.
Larry arranged for you to have another live debate with June Hanley in 2 weeks. The woman is nuts, so are you.
Your on-the-air persona is really just a cover-up, isn't it? For the anger and deep-seated issues that you really have?
The collision between Dave and June is mostly predictable, with June's character behaving condescendingly unchristian. But the later scene, where June has a private minor breakdown, is most engrossing. So we see Dave at various ages and emotional milestones of his life, including a traumatic incident during his adolescent years. Damn that Stewie Gardarella! While the revelation of what happened is quite unpleasant, we are led to believe that this one incident is entirely responsible for Dave's hunted, almost haunted adult persona. Could it be PTSD? And it is this unsure person, jokingly dubbed by Chris as Sir David, office freak of Buffalo, who ends up facing another, more serious trauma. How Dave decides to handle or not handle this later crisis will affect everyone around him, including young Margaret in Brazil. A funny line about the pending adoption goes, "Well, some people might find bringing an orphan child from poverty to Buffalo redundant." Don Chimay portrays David, and the film is based on his own stage production of the same name. Mr. Chimay co-produced the film, and the spot-on original music is by Mark Jackson. The supporting cast, including Guy Adkins, Antoinetta LaVecchia, and Jordan Baker, are all strong anchors to a tricky scenario. There are some quirky moments, like an intense revelation scene between Dave and Kate set during their school years. As the action goes back and forth, we sometimes see the adults portraying their younger selves, and sometimes we see different younger actors as the same pair, all in the same scene. It's an odd choice, but it works. Don't we all carry our younger selves into older ages? This also reveals why a traditional linear plotline probably would not have worked as well for this particular story. Despite the sometimes trite dialogue and David's often maddening self-sabotage, we find that Dave, and all the Daves of the world, can still succeed. He advises a young girl who is being harassed and seriously doubting herself, "Don't listen to what people say if it isn't right in your head." Now that is some darn good gay talk.
If you're out there and you're listening, you know who you are. And that's what counts the most.
For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
The David Dance is now available on Amazon Prime and Vimeo On Demand. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Christopher Gall and John Dyer V, produced with Brian DeShazer, Outcasters Drew and Andrew, produced by Mark Sofus, and from John Dyer V. The Indigo Girls performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, John Beaupre, Richard Merck, and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 5PBA Salisbury, South Australia, KAZU Pacific Grove, California, WVEWLP Brattleboro, Vermont, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.